Welcome. This is Why Life Is, and I'm your host, Niles McFlower. Tonight we have another great show dealing with metaphysics and spirituality and science and whatever. And I thought also, I didn't quite get everything in last week dealing with the questions of power and evil. So I thought I would add a little bit in tonight's show. Some people obviously will, if they didn't hear last week's show, might be wondering what I'm talking about. But in general, I think we'll get the gist of it. So I'm going to say things that'll make sense even if you didn't hear last week's show. And tonight's show is going to be human initiation into the next kingdom, which really is a process, and I'm going to talk about it in historical terms, why things are the way they are, how they've changed, and a lot of other interesting thoughts. Even if you've heard me talk about this subject before, either on this station or one of the other ones, it doesn't really matter, because tonight's show is going to have a lot of different information presented in a different way. So I think that you'll find it to be just as interesting, if not more so, than any prior show, and certainly not redundant. That's the important thing. Right? So hopefully you'll find that to be something that you want to hear about. So let me talk about power and evil, because I didn't quite get some concepts in last week, and I would like to do that, because it sort of is important. It's important in the general understanding of how evil works. Power, generally, is part of God, provided that it's separated, as God chooses to separate power, by both dimensionality and away from its own thought and out of its control, so to speak, most of the time, with the opportunity for those parts of life that choose to co-create with God's thought to then use power to, in their own ways, in their own creations, to co-create and creating more light in the world. So this is a good thing. Power could be used that way. God chooses not to exercise or use all of its power itself, because that would be to take away freedom from life, and it would reverse the process that it seeks, God seeks, to have life be autonomous and able to be a creator in its own right. Now, if we look at evil, evil realizes that power is the way to gain control of over other life and try to steal it from God's, we'll say, light, and move it away from God's thought in general. And it recognizes several principles, and let me go into those principles so that you can sort of follow what evil thinks. First is, and these are true statements now, this is not just what evil thinks and it's false, it's what evil thinks and is correct, at least as far as accuracy is concerned, not as far as being good or bad, but it's accurate. If you concentrate, as you concentrate power into a narrower and narrower range of life and consciousness, the power becomes exponentially more powerful. So it has a greater effect on a greater number of other types and other beings of life, and it does so with greater ease on the part of those who are exercising it. So concentration of power is one of the secrets that evil uses in order to gain control over others and to enslave, eventually, others and or destroy them, depending upon its own decisions and needs. And this is important because we have to be able to recognize those around us who may be trying to concentrate power, because that means they're going towards the dark side. And it's another way to recognize evil. Anytime you see a huge grab for more concentration of power, be on the lookout, be on the alert. Now, you might say, well, how does it do that? Why is it exponentially so much stronger? Because it seems like it should be like some kind of linear thing or something, you know. More power, yeah, okay, you can do more stuff, but why does it suddenly become exponential, and what is the principle in a metaphysical sense, if not pure physics as well, as far as how it accomplishes that. And let me try to explain it this way. Power is not a zero-sum game. In other words, if two people have power, one doesn't have more because the other one has less or something like that in terms of relative terms. So that is the confusing part, because a lot of people think concentration of power means that other people don't have it. It doesn't exactly work like that, actually. Concentration of power has to do with something to do with time and space. Now, I'm going to try to explain this in a way that will be more easily understood by people who aren't that familiar with physics. Okay, so think of it this way, that in order to control and to use power, one must be able to move the power from one place to another and to change the form of energy that is producing the power from one kind to another. This could even be extra dimensional, but for right now, let's just think of it in terms of one dimension, like here in the physical dimension of the universe. And so this is a little hard to get. I'll try to explain it. That, let's say I wanted to exert a lot of power on something. Well, I would need to not only exert it where I'm at, but I need to exert it where it's going to end up being, because power involves, as you may or may not know, movement, and it movement through time and space. So having a potential for power is one thing, but actually using the power causes a change in time and space. And so you can have potential power, or you can have actual use of power, in which case you're moving time, you're moving something through time and space. So this is where it gets really interesting, because instead of the power effectively being between me and other beings, so to speak, it's between me and the time and space that I am able to exercise the power over, and whether or not when I'm doing that, I'm able to keep it very concentrated. And the more concentrated I can use it, the more efficient I am at getting the job done or whatever I want to do. Now, if I'm trying to use it in a destructive way, like dark forces do, I'm taking power from their abilities to use power, and at the same time, I'm using that power to confine or restrict their ability to reach the same places in time and space that I do. So, interestingly, I'm isolating them in a particular locale, and I'm also reducing their ability to be conscious, because if they don't have the knowledge about other times and spaces, then they won't have the ability to understand them, and their consciousness will become lowered, which is what I really want to do, because as their consciousness becomes lowered, they're easier to dupe, and I can get more and more control over them. It's a very interesting process. You might say, well, what does all that mean then, in terms of, like, how this all functions in the real world? Well, in the real world, people who are dark are continually trying to gain the ability for others to not be able to make decisions, because they can't figure out what direction they're really moving in, because they don't understand where and what I'm doing if I'm dark. And they don't understand how to get around the use of power that I'm using. So they become threatened, they become afraid that some type of harm, oftentimes real harm, might occur towards them, because they have no way of dealing with the power that I'm exercising, because they can't understand it, and they don't have control of the time and space I'm exercising. Now, let's be real practical about this. Let's say I'm a government, and I'm a dictator in a government. Okay. Or I'm just maybe one of the dictators in a government. And I decide that, oh, gee, I'm going to force everybody to wear their underwear on the outside of their pants. If you're familiar with Woody Allen's movie Bananas, then you know what I'm talking about. And I would say everybody has to wear underwear on their outside of their pants so I can tell whether or not they're clean or not, because I've decided that clean underwear is one of the things that I'm going to control about people. You notice the control thing is always part of this. I want to control their actions, and I want to control their thought about even their actions. But I'm definitely controlling their behavior as well, as you can see. And I'm restricting their time and space because they're going to have to obviously change the way they live and how they dress and all kinds of weird things, all in relationship to what my dictatorial demands are upon them, okay? And in this process of doing this, I'm doing it because of my need for ego and gratification. I believe I'm right and they're wrong, and I don't care about them anyway, not really, although I do care about their underwear being clean, so they got to wear it on the outside of their pants. All right. Now, is that a form of abuse of power? Oh, absolutely, because I'm controlling many of the decisions that they might use in their life. It isn't just about the underwear. It's about all kinds of elements of their life get into play here, and eventually their time and space is very restricted, and their number of choices is really cut down. And I'm using this power to do this. But at the same time, I'm taking power away from them because they have much less ability to use their time and energy in ways that will be creative for them. They're now my stooge. They're going to create for me whatever I want them to by these ridiculous edicts I make that control their life, you see. And that's what evil does. Now, how does evil achieve the concentration of power that's necessary? Well, it does this in a very simple way. If you're familiar with, like, multi-level marketing, I'm not saying all multi-level marketing is necessarily evil, but it kind of follows the same system, and I want you to follow this with me. Evil tries, within its own, we'll say, order, it tries to gain power among other evil beings and those that are dark as well, by taking a large collective of people that it can control, taking power from those people, and it moves up a triangle or a pyramid type shape in which those towards the top have more and more power over those below it. That doesn't mean those at the very bottom have no power, because they're still trying to exercise some power over someone. And so this system concentrates power. It's designed for the purpose of concentration of power, and it's anti-God. It's against the principle that God has, which is power should be diffuse, and it should be based upon one's own creative efforts, and on an individual level, not a collective level. When power becomes collectivized, it becomes concentrated, and it becomes dark. This is one of the principles of why socialism and collective economies generally are dark, because of this very concept of power and how it is wielded by those in those kinds of systems. And there's no way around it. As soon as you start concentrating power, you're moving away from freedom of choice and towards darkness. Even if the original intent is to do something good, in some socialized economies in the past that are small, it has, at the beginning of the process, sometimes been looking like a panacea of sorts. So, well, everybody's looking for the common good. It's a very egalitarian thing. And, of course, the word social justice, which the Nazis used frequently, by the way, is part of the program. But the real truth of it is that as the power became more and more concentrated, even in some of the most egalitarian societies back in the 19th century, before the 20th, they still turned dark. And the reason they turned dark is because the power became more and more concentrated towards the few who were running things. And inevitably, It removes the choices of the many, regardless of how good the few are trying to be. You can't be good in replacement of other people's consciousness and creativity and say that's a good thing. You might be trying to do good things for them, but you're doing so much destruction by removing their choices and removing their freedoms and reducing their consciousness that is by and far more dangerous and more destructive than whatever decisions, even if they're good decisions in the sense of, well, it make people more healthy or wealthy or whatever. Even if that's the case, which it usually isn't in the long run, but even if it were, the destruction to the basic inalienable rights of human beings and life to grow, to become more of its creator, that's the real bottom line, and that's what you're taking from people. And when you take that away, nothing else you do can replace it. I hope that makes some sense. And I'm going to move on now. Now you could say, where did that all come from? Well, listen to last week and it'll kind of fit together. Hopefully that kind of completes the picture for you and gives you a better, more rounded understanding of what we really didn't finish last week, which, of course, needs in my mind, to be completed at least to the level we stop right now. Okay, so let me continue on now and start basically what is today's show, which is on human initiation into the next kingdom. And I want to start by stating that this is not a set situation. It is like a moving, growing target. And for that reason, I want to go back in time over 100 years ago so that we can look at where things were then and how they sort of evolved and changed as a matter of necessity and something that involves beyond the human kingdom to fully understand. So I'm going to be revealing some things that I think I'm okay about revealing that were decisions made by those a kingdom or so ahead of human beings. If we go back, let's say to the turn of the 20th century, 19th and 20th centuries, at that time, the process of gradually, by our standards, changing into a being greater than the consciousness and abilities and responsibilities of a human being would require mostly individual endeavors. And this process involves someone deciding to spiritually discipline themselves, and after a while of doing this, in what is called the first level of initiation, where they were mostly doing things on a physical level, to be of service to others and to help out. As they approached the end of that process, they would meet a member of the next kingdom. Now, usually they didn't get a telegram or anything. This being for the next kingdom would just appear. But sometimes, literally, a few of them even got telegrams. But whatever or however it was arranged, they would meet one or more, usually one, member of the next kingdom who had some similar responsibilities and interests to the way that this person was serving. And if they were a member of a group of people doing this, they still met the member of the next kingdom on an individual level. So they didn't meet them all together at the same time. And during the process, that becomes the teacher. That became the teacher of the individual, we'll call it, spiritual disciple in the level of initiation. And eventually, that person would, especially in the first initiation, reach a point where they became responsible for others, and they would start teaching a little bit to others, and they also would usually form a group, if they hadn't already done so, of people to co-serve with them. But they still, as far as the relationship with this member or master of Ageless Wisdom of the Next Kingdom, they would have a one-on-one individual relationship. That's what a lot of books were written about, especially around or before the turn of the 20th century. However, there were some problems with this. First of all, people became kind of like egotistical, thinking they were special. They became feeling like they were blessed or being given special attention because now they had contact with the super being. And that wasn't good. So it kind of like puffed them up, made them feel something special about themselves. They oftentimes would become enamored. In other words, all their attention was about whether or not they were pleasing or helping or whatever, listening to even, this member of the next kingdom. And a lot of focus went in that direction. That is called, in some cases, blamers or fixed desires of people that amount these teachers that they were having, a teacher they had. And so that wasn't a good thing either. So there were some negative drawbacks. And this process had been going on for thousands of years, so it had been tolerated. And then most of their focus was on mentally becoming true in their thoughts and astrally becoming clear in their astral body so that they weren't contaminated with too many glamours, too many fixed desires. And they could have really strong affinity and love for those they were serving. This is a very good thing. There's nothing wrong with it per se. Yet, there was very little development of another body called the buddhic or intuitional body in these people. They really didn't, so most of the communication was on their terms in their mental and astral natures rather than in terms of the next kingdom, which actually thinks in this other way, this intuitional or buddhic thought. And so there was very little actual direct communication in that way and very little service in comparison to later on. Another thing that happened was societies emerged. And one of them, the largest actually, was called the Theosophical Society. At one time it had 20, 30, even more million members. And a section of that society called the Eastern Star Part had like 8 million members who were people who, many of them were supposedly involved in this initiation process. So it's a large number of people, if you think about the size of the world then compared to today, there was a quarter as many people on Earth. So, I mean, that's quite a few people to be involved in this. But unfortunately, the number of people at the head of this society, the couple societies actually, the Eastern Star was sort of an offshoot, became very glamored about the fact that they were the head of a society that was having, a lot of its members were having quite a bit of contact with these other members of another kingdom. They themselves, some of them did have some, if not a lot, of contact. And they became kind of, we'll call it, this relates to last week's show, seeking power over others, seeking an authority, like, I'm a higher initiate, I run this society, I know this guy or that master or whatever. And this was very negative as far as the next kingdom was concerned. So about the year 1925, but for several years before that, there was discussion and finally a decision made that only those who had already had some contact or were about to have contact with members of the next kingdom would do so any longer on an individual level. Well, for the people who were around then, it didn't seem to change much for them because that covered a lot of different people. But as time marched on for a number of years and then decades, very few people were having much contact, that meant, with members of the next kingdom because the people who had had contact were gradually aging and eventually leaving this dimension for the next. So the whole system was changing now. And it was deliberately done this way because it was felt a very negative thing that human beings who were supposedly very much capable of better mental thinking were relying too much on these masters to do some of their thinking for them. But the masters really thought in terms of intuitional thought, and the humans weren't coming up to the master's level. The masters were going down to the human level. And they finally said, you know, that isn't working out too good. So we'll make it then. If someone wants to have communication with a master of the ageless wisdom, they're going to have to develop this intuitional thought in themselves, and they're going to have to do it through group service rather than just individually doing their stuff. So this became a whole new set of requirements, and the original rules for initiation, which all based on individual capabilities and responses, sometimes done while a member of a group, but sometimes not, became less and less generic to the whole process because it was only for the older folks, and those people were leaving. And for younger people, the new requirements are called group rules for initiation. And to date, no one has accomplished going through these new group rules for initiation, which are considerably different and more difficult than the individual. The first reason being that you have to use some level of intuitional thought to even have much contact with a master in any case. And then on top of that, if you're going to complete an initiation in the physical world, now this is a very important element, you're going to need to do it through a group and with a group of others who are working together as one. Wow. That sounds a lot more difficult if you think about it. Now, you can go on to eventually finish an initiation that you start in the physical world when you die from the astral world and go on to the mineral world and start your developed life there. It's possible to actually complete an initiation there. But there you still do it in a group. You're following, but you're much more capable of following the group rules once you reach the mineral world because you're much more conscious. But the ability to do it in the physical world is lost because your level of consciousness won't be high enough based upon these new standards. So this is a very different thing now. People were used to, quote-unquote, taking and receiving initiation in the physical world on a fairly regular basis. If you go back to the beginning of the 20th century, and now it's extremely rare, if ever, that someone will finish an initiation in the physical world. And so that's become a very different kind of procedure. It's also left a gap. It's left a large amount of space, you might say, between spiritually disciplined people and the members of the next kingdom. They did that deliberately, the next kingdom did, because they don't want very much contact with humans because it didn't seem to work out all that well. And especially as humans have become more egotistical and more arrogant, they're sent and more glamored by their sense of superiority for having any contact with some kind of super being, those people are all ignored. You have to have amazing humility and not be very much affected by the fact that you even have any contact with a member to the next, from the next kingdom to even have such kind of contact. So you can see this is a really different kind of system. I'll explain some of these group rules and how they've changed everything as we move through the program tonight. But I think it's important at this point to recognize huge changes in 100 years. I mean, just huge changes have taken place in terms of what used to be called the process of initiation. Now, I'm going to, as the next part now, just quickly go over what this process of initiation is, because it's not common in other worlds. It's something that's familiar, and we've known about it a long time here on Earth, most worlds don't ever use it. And, of course, I'll explain why that is the case. But it is a more difficult process in some ways and more dangerous in terms of its benefits versus its troubles. So let me start by saying this, that in order to move from the human kingdom to the next kingdom, we as human beings initiate ourselves. This is not something someone else does for us, through our service, using the senses in each of our bodies, and the information that comes through those senses, created into knowledge, and then eventually, with the level of consciousness that we have, used to serve others. The more we serve others, the more that we unify our senses, the more accurate the information, therefore, coming through the senses, and the better the knowledge is that we then use to help us create love-giving wisdom to others so they can do the same thing. We start living as souls, which is a wonderful thing about it. And this process begins with us doing it for ourselves, but at a certain point in time, because it would take many more lifetimes than is useful for all of humanity to advance, the next kingdom and the one after that, the next two kingdoms, have teamed up to help us complete the process by literally fusing our centers together in the appropriate body in a few seconds. Now you might think, what? It could take literally many lifetimes, more than a dozen in some circumstances, to a successful lifetime, too. Some of them could be wasted, so they don't even count. But successful lifetimes of service to unify the centers, saying halfway or 55% of the way or whatever the present level is, so that they're working together and the information that comes through them is less illusion and we're able to create much more accurate and wise knowledge that can be given. These are good things, and it helps to build our consciousness as we do that because we become more able to apply the knowledge in so many different ways. This is all wonderful stuff. However, the last part of fusing those centers together could take longer than the first half of it. You might say, why would it take longer? Shouldn't it go like at least as fast, if not faster, if you're really building up? Well, yes and no. The yes part is that proportional math would tell you that it shouldn't be any longer and you should gain something in the process, so you should go faster. But there's a little catch. And the catch is that the closer you come to perfection, the harder it is not to make some mistake that prevents further fusing of these centers. So actually it takes longer, not less time, because there's this other quality to it. And so if it took 12 lifetimes, it could take 20 to finish the process. And that's a huge amount of time to talk about lifetimes. And there isn't enough time in the plan of our planet for human beings to help develop the planet and make it successful for enough people to become initiated in this process or to even move into the next kingdom. There won't be enough humans becoming superhumans in the time allotted. So the plan is, okay, we don't wait for the human being to go ahead and finish this on their own because there won't be enough time for the humans to do it. So instead, a few masters get together, including members that are way far advanced, even the normal masters, and they get together and they fuse through think of it like welding or something, but it's welding using three different kinds of kundalini energy called Pingala, Ida or Ida, and Satsumi. These types of energies, when they're joined together, diffuse the centers. And they raise this energy themselves and guide it through the respective centers of the body that they're fusing at the time. And bingo bango, you are then have the fused centers. Now, just because you have the fused centers doesn't mean you've completed the process, because then you have to learn how to flow energy through all the centers, create accurate knowledge with the information that comes through without illusion, and then, most importantly, use love, wisdom, and give it to others to help them to do some of the same and live a life of really full service with this great ability. Even though you've been zapped, doesn't mean you're necessarily going to do this, because it's a huge change in perspective, consciousness, and life to be able to live what's been given you, which is this unified sense. Now, once you're zapped, that's it. That body will remain zapped even into the next lifetime, unless you become evil. And you could separate the centers, but most of the time people don't. And so they keep that wonderful gift, but their use of it in a way of service is up to them. And if they don't use it of service, they get flooded with a lot more information than they normally would, that they're usually not using accurately or in well enough ways, and the results can be a lot of diseases can come about, a lot of confusion, a lot of emotional and mental kinds of problems, all can come about by having centers that are more together that you aren't using in service. So it's important to realize that it's sort of a gift, but then again, if you don't use it right, it can be a real serious negative, real serious problem because of everything I'm describing to you and how it works. Now, a lot of people don't know what I'm explaining to you tonight because, frankly, this word initiation, etc., has been deliberately confused by the dark side so that you don't even know what it means anymore. I'm making it very practical so that you can understand it. And, of course, if you still don't understand, you can always call me. And right now, while I'm on the air, or call me later, or you can email me, or whatever you want to do. But the point is that this is a straightforward process. It isn't magic. There's a way that it works, and it's founded in physics. Okay, so people have the choice whether to use their centers after they've become unified by this magical process or not. The first initiation fuses together the physical senses about 10% of the way. And then the astral senses a few percent, and the mental senses even less than that. And so there's a progression. You start off with the physical body being the most fused. And you don't get completely fused just because you've been zapped one time. As a matter of fact, if they did completely fuse the centers, nobody that I could imagine or think of could use their bodies that way, and without it probably creating more problems than solving. So they do this in stages, they being the members of the next kingdom. The first initiation works almost exclusively on the physical body, which is a little tiny bit in the astral, even less in the manasic. And then you move on. And then in the second level of initiation, this is in today's standards, and it changes over time, it rises to about 25%. And the second body, which is added in full connection, is fused to the first body to the same level. So this first body, which is the physical in the second level of initiation, is fused to the level of about 25%. The astral body is fused to about 25%, and the two bodies together are fused to about 25%. And the mental body then is raised, and a little bit of the intuitional body is then involved. So you see there's this gradual process of building that's taking place by a person's service. Anyway, we're going to come back and talk a lot more about this in about 2 minutes or so and 30 seconds from right now.
Hun, what book are you reading?
It's a novel, kind of, about romance, love, and spiritual life in general.
Kind of a novel? What do you mean?
Well, it's based on some real-life experiences and even real characters. Some of their experiences are fascinating and remarkable. I can't put this book down.
How come the title is Afterlife Love?
That's part of the fascination. This book describes the afterlife in intricate detail and even explains why things are the way they're explained.
But how can anyone write about or know that?
Some of the characters travel out of body to some places that people who've already died also go to. I'm finding it completely believable because it all makes sense and fits into a bigger picture for me.
Hun, what happens to these people?
You can read it for yourself when I'm done if you want.
Better yet, I'll get my own copy so we can discuss it while we read. Let me see. I'll write down the title. It's Afterlife Love by Niles McFlower. McFlower.
Afterlife Love is available in some bookstores and from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com or 480-966-3132. That's 480-966-3132.
Hi, everyone. Since childhood, I've had questions about my life and life in general that I couldn't find adequate answers to. Questions like, why am I here? Why are others here? Does the universe have a purpose? And how does that relate to my life? More recently, I've been wondering what happens when we die, especially the reasons why. I'm more of a doubter than a believer in many things, and answers that include the whys allow me to think and figure out the truth for myself. I've been reading a book, Life's Hidden Meaning. This one book contains more answers, including the whys, than all other sources I've read or heard. It's amazing to me that every one of my questions has been thoroughly answered. More importantly, I have found that all of these answers so far have checked out to be true. I hope this message helps some of you in your quest for better understanding. The name of this wonderful book is, again, Life's Hidden Meaning by metaphysician Niles McFlower. Some bookstores sell it. I got my copy directly from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com. Life's Hidden Meaning may enlighten your mind and bring some peace and joy to your heart.
We're back. This is Why Life Is, and I'm your host, Niles McFlower. Tonight we're talking about human initiation into the next kingdom, and I'm going to cover it, I think, in better detail with hopefully clearer examples so that people really do understand this process, which is a little obscure, particularly if you read some books about it. Some of them are better than others, but generally speaking, most of them are at least semi-mystical, meaning that they don't put it in plain English, as I hope I'm doing tonight. All right, so let me continue on. And we sort of stopped in the process of moving from a physical service to an additional physical and astral service. You notice that you don't really stop being physical in your service. You're just adding a more astral component, and both are being raised to a new level. You went from maybe 10% of your physical body and senses being used in service to others. Now, that may not sound like much, but that's actually quite a bit for a lot of people. It's a lot. And in some realms and some religions, that's considered an extremely high level of quote-unquote spiritual or religious service within their doctrines. But nonetheless, I'm saying that that's the beginning of this whole process. And then you move on to the second initiation. And during that time, you're trying to achieve about a 25% level of both the physical and astral body senses in your service. You go through four stages, by the way, five if you consider one of them like a pre-stage, in each one of these initiations. The first is an aspirant, someone who really isn't yet serving but wants to. That's why it doesn't really count. But there's a lot of people who go through that several times on and off in their lifetime and may go on to the next stage or they may not. It depends upon where they're coming from. And so these stages really have a lot to do with the choices that we make in how far we're willing to go into the process of self-initiation, because it's done by us. It isn't done by somebody else. Nobody else is really even directing what we do. we direct ourselves and choose to what level we're going to function. And so, you know, it's a process in which you can become fully immersed, or a process in which you stop at any point along the way. Each one of these stages eventually leads someone to become a leader of a spiritual group and gain some other contact besides just with their oversoul or solar angel and their soul. We'll just call that in one case as one being, like, in other words, you have soul contact during most of the time that you are using these different levels of initiation. But when you reach the accepted stage, that's a really important stage. It's the end. And in the accepted stage, you not only gain some contact, additional contact, with your soul, but that contact is joined with another being that's part of you called the monad. What is that? It's like a being of pure consciousness that helps us to become far more creative. And we become more co-creative with God in that process. We get a clearer picture of God at the end of each of the initiations. It's pretty neat stuff. I really think that that's fantastic. And it's amazing how people actually do go through different stages of doing this, and you can even find it recognizable. The most important thing, though, to remember is that you're doing it to yourself. You're helping yourself to become of greater service to others by using your senses more and more and helping others to do the same in ways that are enlightening, that are spiritual. Most people use their senses selfishly. Now, as you use your senses to enlighten others, the senses themselves that you're using become enlightened, and the retained energy in them moves out, and the accuracy of the information they provide is tremendously improved, and the amount of information they provide is also tremendously increased. You literally gain a super memory, an incredible ability to instantly become aware of almost anything around you. That doesn't mean you're aware of everything all the time. It just means you have the ability to become almost instantly aware, if necessary, of whatever it's about or whatever's around, provided that you are serving others. This is a great system, and it was designed to accelerate the process of the human kingdom developing itself, a critical kingdom, by the way, so that Earth could become a sacred planet more quickly, like thousands and thousands of years earlier, maybe even a million years earlier, than it might under a non-initiatory process. Most planets choose not to use initiation. And you might ask yourself, well, why in the heck do they do that if you can go faster? Well, the danger in this speed business is that a lot of people, a lot of human beings, flunk out of it. Remember how hard it is to do. It's self-initiated. The possibility is that you might get glamored. You might become egotistical or arrogant. There's a lot of problems that can arise. And as they do, they may push you off to the spiritual path. This is the difficulty. Too many people fail in comparison to those that succeed. And it's really dependent more upon the few moving the many ahead rather than vice versa. And that's more dangerous because if the few fail, then everybody fails. Now, other planets go much more slowly, but they depend upon a much larger group of humans to carry out the gradual spiritual development of humanity. And they're far more successful with fewer failures. But they take a lot longer time. Our planet has decided that its time is precious. It needs to go faster because one of the experiments we're doing in this world is trying to find ways to overcome evil, a unique kind of evil that's much more mental than other types of planets have. And so if we are successful, we can add to the entire universe's collection of goodness and how to deal with the problems of monastic or mental evil. But if we fail, well, then we fail. Other planets are trying at the same time, but not that many, because the chances of failure are still pretty high. Earth is only so-so, probably not doing the greatest right now. And so the chance of failure is high. It's not the easiest thing. But it's worthwhile to try, especially if you understand anything I'm saying, because nothing can be more meaningful in a human's life than to go through this process and to be of value and service to others. Tremendously important. And it's a wonderful thing to have. It really is. And when people do succeed, they have tremendous joy. And if they make it through past the third level of initiation, you start having something called bliss, which goes beyond joy, constant joy or continuous joy. So these are good things to be, we'll say, involved in. But the failures, in comparison to the bliss and the joy, could sometimes really disrupt you. And they could lead to a great deal of suffering at certain stages. Not all the time, not in every lifetime, but some lifetimes can be real kick-ass suffering, terrible. And other lifetimes can be just amazingly wonderful. The reason for it is that there are things within us that have to be called fetters, that have to be overcome. And in some lifetimes, we choose, while we're in the soul consciousness, that's the lifetime we're going to get rid of this fetter or that fetter, sometimes a bunch of them. And the results can be a really, really tough life. There's no question about that. But those are not necessarily such bad things, because, again, time is of the essence. We're all trying to do this not based upon what we feel or like, but what is needed in service. And we have a pretty good understanding then of what our service is. So, human initiation into the next kingdom can be, we might say, the most wonderful overall enterprise any human being can take on, with certain parts of it becoming some of the worst suffering that any human being can ever experience, other than evil. Evil will eventually suffer worse than any kind of suffering that any other human being will do. That's another thing we didn't cover last week, is what happens to evil eventually. But I don't think I'll cover it yet, because I want to continue to go into human initiation. All right, so basically this structure is designed to presently go from the human kingdom to the kingdom of souls, as it's sometimes referred to, the next kingdom beyond human, within four levels of initiation presently. Those four levels are the physical, the astral, the mental, and finally the intuitional. Those bodies have to have a certain level of fusion. In the case of the three lower bodies, the physical, astral, and mental, while a human being, the initiate has to complete the process with the help of the next kingdom of fusing all of the senses in that body into one. Now, the fourth initiation at the present time is a little more complicated, and I'll try to explain it to you. This is a person sometimes referred to as an arhat. And if they're at the end of the initiation, they're sometimes referred to as an adept. In the past, some adepts were just called masters because the level of being a master was just to the adept level. But now it's gone beyond that. Okay, so here's how it works. It's a little strange. But for the fourth level of initiation, you don't have to fuse all of the Buddhic or intuitional body into one sense. As a matter of fact, you only have to fuse the three lowest of the senses of the seven that are available. Those three deal with really the three lower bodies themselves, and they connect to each one of the three lower bodies. So you have to do those three, or else you can't complete becoming a member of the next kingdom. But the remaining four you can work on while you become a member, or you are a member of the next kingdom. So it's a little different. The other thing that's kind of strange about it is that zapping with the kundalinis is not exactly done by members in the next kingdom for the arhat, or for the person in the fourth level of initiation. First of all, there isn't exactly the same kind of thing happening. Each one of the three kundalinis is actually connecting one of these three sub-senses in the Buddhic body to one of the three lower bodies itself. And that's done by the human, her or himself. The masters are involved in certain ways about this process, but for the most part, the initiation is much more done by the initiate than by the members of the next kingdom. They do play a role, and I'm not allowed to tell you what that role is at this time, but the role is not the same as it is in the prior initiations. So it's a different kind of process, and you could consider it much more the responsibility of the individual arhat to complete it, rather than for the members of the next kingdom, as they do in the earlier initiations, to do most of the work, because they don't. You might say they act more as a limiting source than a helpful source of sorts. And again, I can't tell you anymore. That's all I'm allowed to tell you. And believe me, if you really need to know this, you're going to know it anyway. You won't need to know it from me. So here's the interesting thing about this. This whole amazing process actually changes us into a different kind of being, because we fuse with our soul. The soul is the part of us that's in the higher manasic or mental plane. We fuse with that soul gradually through the whole process, and eventually, at the fourth initiation, that soul moves from the fourth sub-plane of the second sub-plane in the mental world. Okay, and that's the higher conceptual mind, some people call that. To, are you ready? The fourth sub-plane, or excuse me, the fourth sub-plane, said that wrong, the fourth sub-plane of the intuitional body. So the soul leaves the mental world completely, the higher mental world specifically, where it's found. It leaves that place, and it leaves the fourth sub-subplane of the second subplane of the mental world, and it enters into the intuitional world, and it lives then in the fourth subplane of the intuitional plane. It's living in a different dimension of time and space, which with more dimensionality to it. And it becomes, at that point, some people call it a liberated soul or free soul, because it has much more capabilities from that perspective. And from the four subplane down in the intuitional world, it has freedom to communicate and thought, et cetera, whereas it didn't have that in the mental world. Also, it gives up a thing called the causal body to its students. It literally gives up pieces of its own mental mind to its students permanently. And in some cases, it may even give some pieces to another being, another soul. It gets pretty complicated. But the important thing is, it depends how many members are in its group, it gets a little fairly complicated process. But it's an amazing thing that it is a transformational process of a human being creating itself into another being. It's converting its senses, its bodies, its mind, its consciousness into another kingdom. And it's doing so fully self-conscious. It's not doing it in some subconscious way. It's not doing it because something else is manipulating or changing it. It does it on its own. And that's the incredible story about being a human being, is that we are here to do these incredible things on our own. Talk about co-creating with God. We are as close as you could imagine someone becoming a God and changing oneself from one kingdom into a member of a higher kingdom. Wow. And remember, at each stage in this process of initiation, a person is moving more and more through their own efforts in the fusion process of their senses. They are helped considerably in the three lower initiations compared to the fourth. But there's no question that they are more involved and have a great deal more as far as their responsibility in doing so as they proceed through the entire initiation process. Okay, there's four stages that each initiation has, and then there's four initiations. So it's kind of symmetrical in a lot of ways. Each one of the stages corresponds to one of the senses and bodies that the person is disciplining. How does discipline play a role in this? What in the heck is discipline, in case you don't know? Spiritual discipline is the ability to change and improve upon a sense by concentrating and focusing on that sense to elevate it, and then to, like a stepping stone, raise each other sense to that level and gradually improve each sense in that way. So it's like, I'll improve this one sense, and then I'll bring the next one of the remaining six senses to that level, subsenses to that level, until I eventually get all of the subsenses up, and then I'll keep moving up and up and up. Now, if it was that, by the way, if it was that systematic, we wouldn't have any problems, but most human beings have a preference for some senses over others. They are somewhat, that's caused by selfishness or illusion. And so they may not do the process as evenly and nicely defined as I just explained it. Sometimes they even try to take improvements in one whole body more than another, and that's called split discipleship. And that's very difficult because then they're trying to do work on more than one initiation at the same time, and having not completed one, they're going on to the next. Usually it's caused by spiritual ambition. Sometimes by laziness about not wanting to deal with certain senses in certain bodies and other reasons as well. So this is a complicated process as far as the intricacy of how a person is going to, we'll say, choose to go through it. But it's rather straightforward in terms of what they're actually doing. The complications only come from the choices that a person may or may not make along the way. Sometimes we get zapped, and we don't want it because it's very uncomfortable. The flooding of information for a lot of people causes actually mental confusion, sometimes headaches and other problems, literally a sense of disease, because there's a huge amount more energy that a person has to deal with all at the same time. And if they choose not to, they end up clogging up their centers and cause themselves to get sick. What are some of the illnesses that spiritual disciples get from this sort of, we'll say, misbehavior? Well, the ones that are first come to mind usually involves neurological issues, and often affects memory, affects things like headaches, we'll call them headaches, and also it can cause emotional and mental problems. And a person can become significantly imbalanced. They may get depressed. They may become manic. They may lose their perspective of self. All these things are dangers from this process of initiation. And the more you make it complex by making mistakes in it, the worse the outcomes usually are from one lifetime to the next. You can correct those things. if you go back and more methodically deal with the disciplines that are necessary. But if you don't, you can make your life very miserable, or lives very miserable. Generally speaking, it can take anywhere from a dozen to two dozen or more lifetimes to go through an initiation. The first and second take longer than the third and fourth by far. And the first generally is somewhere around 7, 12, 15 lifetimes, something like that. The second takes the longest and can be two or three dozen or more lifetimes. And the third is generally faster. It can take, it could take 5 or 10 lifetimes, depends upon where the person is coming from. And the fourth generally takes 3 lifetimes. Why does the fourth only take 3 and all the other ones? Because by the fourth initiation, a person has already discovered the truths that they need to understand about themselves. They generally are much more spiritually disciplined and willing to face the worst things about themselves, because that's what's left. Each initiation deals with the easiest things first. The things that are worst in them can be terrible things. Maybe you killed 100 people in a different lifetime or something. You're going to have to deal with that and deal with it in a lot of different ways. And these things are never nice things. They aren't like, gee, I'm in my fourth level of initiation, so now I'm only dealing with the really nice things about me. No, you're usually dealing with the very worst things, because you just didn't deal with those things before. And it usually came from lifetimes that are disparate and usually considerably different from who you are at the time. But they may still affect you in very adverse ways. You still have to deal with them. And so the very worst comes out usually last. And the easiest stuff is usually dealt with first. That's just the way humans are. It's not because the next kingdom says, well, you're going to do it this way or else. No, it just happens to work out that way. That's the way we choose to be. And so you have these amazing kinds, what we'll say, of challenges that a person goes through in each one of the different initiations. The first challenge in the physical body in the first initiation is to work with others rather than to just work alone, and to try to carry out physical actions on a consistent level, coordinating your responses with those of others. It doesn't sound like much, but actually it's pretty difficult to do for people who haven't tried it. And generally it's done for just a few years in each lifetime. Sometimes it could be done 2 or 3 times for a few years in a single lifetime. But it doesn't last like the whole lifetime, because the person is not that spiritually disciplined. And they come into it and leave it a number of times. They may join a spiritual group for only a few years and leave. They may come back when they get a little older, or may not. And sometimes they may skip a lifetime or two before coming back to spiritual discipline as well. A lot of things happen. It's not so simple, unfortunately. Then the second level of initiation is really dealt with more of, again, trying to bring in the astral body, meaning you have to become a lot more giving, a lot more conscious than you were while you're physically disciplining yourself, and increase to the same level, about 25%, the discipline in the physical body. So you don't give up one for the other. You're just adding stuff. It becomes a lot more complicated, to say the least. And during that time, people fail so often because they're usually much better at singular bodies than they are used to using the two bodies together near the same level of information, accuracy, and service. This is quite unusual and very atypical for human beings. So the second initiation becomes the, we'll say, real drama, the real difficult one. Because maybe up to that time, at no time, in hundreds and hundreds of lifetimes, oftentimes 700 lifetimes, has a person ever functioned this way before. Whereas in the first initiation, it's not that foreign to work with one body and focus on one thing at a time. But two bodies and two different ways of functioning, that's really a whole different ballgame. So it's not unusual to see people in the third stage, which is like the pledge stage, stumbling and unable to function, and going back to just trying to accept their teacher in soul, and oftentimes failing at that. And jumping back and forth between the two, inconsistency. Pledge means that you consistently are able to see that you are a soul, that your teacher is the soul. The teacher is usually somebody physically alive, and it's not a member of the next kingdom. And you're also able to see your service pretty consistently without saying, well, gee, I know I'm here to serve, but I don't know really what I'm here to do. Now, they actually get a pretty good understanding of what they're going to be serving about, and that's a good thing. Then they can ease into the accepted stage, which is different than the accepting stage. Accepting is sort of a stage of doubt, where the accepted stage is a stage of complete convinced of what they're here for, because they have this monadic infusion and they become more leadership potential that can lead others. And they become an example of, in this case, at the second initiation, being able to use both bodies at the same time. And also that starts to break something called the kama monastic connection, because as you gain physical and astral discipline, the break between how you think and how you feel starts to become more real, and how you feel no longer governs how you think. It doesn't mean it diminishes your feelings, your astral feelings. You still feel. You just aren't governed or changed in your thinking and the truth about things because you feel a certain thing. But you really break that by using the physical body with the astral body in a consistent and unified way. That really helps. And then you use your mental body for truly reaching truth, for thinking about things in ways that serves others for their truth rather than making you believe that you're always right and they're always wrong, whatever it might be. So you develop humility, and humility is a great thing, fantastic. That goes on all through the second initiation. It's a very important time for people to succeed. Two out of three lifetimes, people usually fail. So it takes a long time to get through this initiation because there's four stages, and they can become an aspirant at any time, in which case they're not really even disciplining themselves. They just desire to. Well, you know, that's not really great. And people go in and out of this thing. So what we think is something consistent can become relatively irregular and inconsistent, depending upon how the person chooses to live their life. The good news is that once you get into the next initiation, which is the third, remember, you're getting zapped. And in the first initiation, they're only zapping you using mostly one kundalini, which is the first, sometimes called pingala. Other people just call it chi. But regardless, that first kundalini is the easiest one for most people to deal with, because we're more familiar with it. It runs through our body just to keep us alive. So it's nothing that all that foreign. The problem is when you've combined the chi or pingala with the second kundalini fire, which is called Ida, or Ida, I think it's pronounced Ida. But when you put these two together, that's very foreign. We're not used to that at all. And we don't even know what that really, it makes you kind of feel imbalanced. Gives you a sense oftentimes of unreality. And makes you feel like you really can't get a grasp on what's going on around you. It's almost like a state of utter confusion, because these two energies are moving in ways that aren't necessarily, they're complementary, but they aren't the same. The Ida produces a sense of urgency and a desire to serve, or it is the opposite. It gives you a sense of fear and ominous, and it's not really a feeling of things being ominous around you. And then at the same time, if it's contrary to what it's supposed to be, which is service, so if you're not serving enough, it gives you a sense of dread and hostility, even irritation. That's what this Ida second thing does while it's moving around with the with the pingala or qi energy inside your body. Also produces a lot more illnesses. So second level initiates have a lot more illnesses than first level because they got these two energies going sometimes in ways that are rubbing each other the wrong way because you have two different bodies. And so you have it moving in this progression, you might say. Well, at the third level of initiation, the good news, I guess, is that you finally get the Shushumi energy, or Shushuma energy, running around with the other two. And it does tend to create some degree of balance, provided you've broken what is known as the common and monastic connection. If you haven't, you're in big trouble. And the people who haven't usually are these split disciples that have kind of gone on without resolving the astral body. Then you end up with a mess. But if you do manage to do it progressively correctly, this third energy, the third kundalini, actually balances the other two, gets you focused mentally, and then your mind is really controlling things. You're able to see what's true, what's not true, and the irritation between the two lower kundalinis isn't so bad, and life becomes more tolerable and easier, less erratic. People don't have the same kind of emotional problems and mental problems either. Another good thing is that you start doing something called the minor elements of renunciation. There's 18 of them. And those are the 18 different ways you were using all of the lower parts of your senses. There's, remember, seven senses, seven major centers in each of the three bodies, so there's 21. That means there's 18 that are ununified and are below the full developed sense. And those 18 ways are almost always encompassing all the ways that you were selfish. But on a conscious level, what you can do, which is really cool, is you can decide what it is that you would like to finally face that's worst about your nature and come up with mental ways of resolving these things so that they can eventually be acted out in the next few lifetimes. You know it's not going to be overnight, but at least you come up with a conclusion of how you're going to renounce those misused senses. Most of it is recognition rather than full application. You may, by example, use examples occasionally proving that you're right to yourself about the misuse of the sense, but you don't resolve it into a total life of service until the next lifetime, until the next initiation. So it takes a while. But once you have convinced yourself of the truth of the renunciations, and you know these to really be all the darkness inside of you, even though you aren't rid of them yet, I mean, there still may be considerable levels of them existing in you, you're free from becoming evil. The reason is that evil, in order to believe, going to last week's show, that you really want power and control over other people, and you want to live your life by concentrating power instead of by building consciousness, in order to do that, you have to still have all the illusion that the renunciations expose. So once the illusion is exposed, you're not going to run off and want to do all this power-hungry controlling nonsense because you know better and you can't fool yourself anymore. So you become, by the standards of the next kingdom, safe to talk to and have contact with. And so after you finish these 18 renunciations, again, they're not the same as living a life of renunciation, as much as that you gain the awareness and understanding of them, then you're not going to become evil. And the next kingdom, literally, will then have or make contact with you, usually your teacher from the next kingdom, not a physical, not a human, but a superhuman from the next kingdom, will make contact with you in a way which is appropriate for your service. And once that takes place, you're on your way to co co-serving to some level with the next kingdom, mostly mentally, mostly by writing and teaching and speaking and doing things like that. But your full life of service through renunciation won't come for some time, usually 1, 2, or more lifetimes into the future when you become an arhat, and you become a fourth level initiate. I'll get into explaining the difference in that. So the third level initiation raises the three kundalini fight, and that's really wonderful. But it doesn't connect, and it does a lot of fusion in the three different bodies, but it doesn't connect all three bodies together at the same time. And it doesn't give a person a sense of, we'll say, disregard or even no longer concerning themselves with what is going on in their bodies. They have to move beyond that. So there's still a lot of selfishness in the third level of this yet. But if they've made it past the renunciations, at least they're safe from evil. If they haven't, there's always the danger that they could turn into some kind of evil master themselves. Terrible possibility if you think about how far they've come and then all of a sudden crash and burn time. Why don't I give you a little bit of a break here? I want to tell you some things that are going on with us, spiritual group I'm a member of. Some of you know we are working on a new type of pain relief formula called Phi Chi. It's Q-I, C-H-I. We pronounce it Phi Chi Chizik. It's pretty interesting stuff. It comes in tablets. And you can take anywhere from 2 to 10, 10 only once, but usually 10, 2 to 8, we'll say, of these tablets. And depending upon the level and kind of pain you have, it's self-regulating. You use it the way you want it, and it will get rid of the pain. If you take too much, you're just probably wasting the stuff. It's not going to hurt you. Unless you take more than the recommended or the suggested amounts, and then, of course, anybody takes too much of anything can do something wrong. But generally speaking, you can use it without too much regard for that issue. And the label explains all that. And so the thing that's really neat about it is that I found that it not only gets rid of the pain, which is great, and if you take a large enough amount, even if you have pretty bad pain, it'll get rid of most or all of that pain within a few hours. That's amazing. In some cases, within minutes, depending upon the level of pain. But it also does something even better than that. The causes of the pain are reduced, in my opinion, by changing the level of retained and or absent chi energy in the nadir system, which is the meridians and the minor centers that surround our whole body and connect into our major centers. So far, I have been amazed at how effective it is used. I took some earlier today. It's working on me great. And you might say, well, how is it that this stuff works so much better than just taking like aspirin or whatever? Well, those things can be helpful, and I'm not going to kid you that they're, you know, for some people, they may be all they need. The point is that those things have many drawbacks. Aspirin can lose as much as a teaspoon of blood in your stomach every time you take a couple aspirin because it's not good for the stomach lining, and it causes a little tiny, like, hemorrhage in your stomach, a little ulcer type of effect. And almost all of the drugs that are available have a lot of negative side effects. Whereas Phi Chi Jizik, unless you overdo it, I mean by a considerable amount, doesn't have any significant side effects. It just basically gets rid of pain and it gets rid of the things that are causing pain, especially if you have things like chronic stuff like arthritis or you know, migraine headaches or neuralgia and different kinds of arthritis. You could even have rheumatoid, which is normally not very treatable, believe me. This can be very helpful for that. If you have sciatica or if you have different kinds of muscular problems. This can be very, very helpful. If you have pain from an injury, it can be effective for that. All kinds of different pain. And that's the unusual thing about this, is that it treats so many different kinds of pains. And some people will find for certain kinds of pains, they have to take one level, one amount, and for others, a different. And it'll be different than other people. Because, again, it's dealing with all these energies that are running around inside us. And so it's just amazingly interactive. It's herbs. What's it made of? Herbs. That's it. It's got two other, like, nutraceutical ingredients, which are fairly common. But it's basically herbs. 61 herbs. That's right. And why don't other people make this stuff? Well, first of all, they wouldn't know how to balance it and make it right unless they're following the science of Tai Chi. But besides that, it's difficult to make and expensive. And they can't become very wealthy making formulas like this because they cost so much to make. But we are doing it because we want to help people to reduce their pains and to get healthier. And so that's our focus. We're thinking about 2 weeks or so, maybe 2 weeks from this coming Monday, we might have some actual tablets made. Now, we have had some capsules that we're doing research with. We decided really not to sell the capsules. It's too complicated because they're way different in terms of the number you have to take. It'll confuse people, and it's just hard enough to even make one product versus literally two because one's in capsule form. And it would have only saved a few weeks of time. So we do have some capsules available, but really at this point we're just going to get the tablets made. They are the ones that are easiest to take. And you can get a lot more of the ingredients in a single tablet. It is actually easier to swallow than the capsules. And so for that reason, they're better. And also you can cut them in half because they're scored. And so you can use partial amounts more easily. Kind of a lot more, we'll say, a lot more efficient in terms of the amount that you use if you can cut them in half. Easier to take for some people that might not like any kind of capsule or tablet. And also, the ability to what I call titrate the dosage is very effective because you're always taking the right amount. And that's the best thing. And you're going to have to do it based upon how you feel in your body. So talk about taking responsibility. This is definitely not that. Okay, let's go back to the initiations and talk about these energies. So the concept here is that we're working with these esoteric energies that are basically unifying our centers, giving us a sense of oneness. The sense of oneness gives us this greater sense of God and our higher beings, like solar angels, souls, and even monads. So we have communication with these other beings more, and eventually have communication with members of the next kingdom or beyond, which we call masters. Some people call masters of the ageless wisdom. So basically, this is what we're doing. It's a very understandable process. It is not hocus pocus. It actually is relatively scientific. Every step of the way, if you are involved in it, you can choose to understand exactly what is taking place with you. Now, if you choose not to understand it, it could be a nightmare because things happen then without much explanation. I try to make it more understandable by teaching about it so that people, if they're involved in it or about to embark on it, they have a better, clearer understanding of what they're experiencing and why. That's what the show is about tonight. Why should we endeavor for this when it sounds like a lot of trouble and sometimes some suffering is involved? Well, part of the reason is that it makes your life much more meaningful. It gives you much greater capabilities to be superhuman yourself. or at least a really good human being during the part about becoming superhuman. It's a terrific answer for anybody who says, is that all there is to life? Because believe me, once you get involved in this process, you won't be saying that anymore. There's a lot more to life, a way lot more to life, more than we can ever comprehend. And the initiation process and spiritual discipline itself is the ticket to getting to that greater meaning in life. Now, is it always great, fun, or some kind of warm and fuzzy kind of event? No. First of all, it involves today group initiation. Now, I'm going to get into this as deep as I think you can understand it. In order to solve the problems that I talked about historically, today we have to work through a group of people who are going through the same process. And they are not doing it individually, they are doing it with us. If we want to take an initiation in the physical world, it is now required to go through what is known as the group rules for initiation. There's 14 of them. And you can't understand them unless you're going through them. So I could spend the next week explaining to you what they're about. I've done this, by the way. And you won't understand them unless you're actually involved in spiritually disciplining yourself and at some of the levels necessary to understand the specific rule. Tell me that isn't esoteric, meaning hidden. It's difficult, but it's not because someone doesn't want you to know. It's because in order to understand what these rules are about, you have to be using them. There's no way to understand them otherwise. It's one of the most amazing parts of metaphysics and spiritual life. All right, so these 14 rules that were originally written by a woman named Alice Bailey, she got them and wrote them down from a master of the ageless wisdom called the Tibetan Master and some of his students that on occasion sort of became him and dictated to Alice as well. She didn't know the difference. And they explained basically that in order to, from that point forward, this is back some time ago, 30s, early 40s, they explained how and why a person needs to go through these rules rather than do everything individually. Alice had actually written down the individual rules for human initiation 20-some-odd years earlier. But now it was incumbent upon her and her group of spiritual disciples to attempt to use these new group rules. Although, interestingly, in the group rules, it's stated that most likely her group and even groups following that would fail. It would take a couple generations ahead for groups to start being successful in their use of the group rules according to the instructions given to Alice. You might say, well, why one person? Why Alice? Why did Alice get this and that other people? Well, Alice is kind of an interesting person, but mostly because she was willing to become the, we'll say, scribe, the writer of what was told to her as accurately as she could without too much of her own thought interfering. Sometimes it did, but most of the time it didn't. And her willingness to do that, and the students that were with her and part of her group were willing to help in the same process, that was part of the reason that she got the job, you might say. Now, she wasn't always appreciated by all the other spiritual groups around at the time, and that isn't surprising because she's the one was introducing these concepts of group initiations in which it was no longer an individual thing, which the spiritual groups of her day were using to gain power over people and control. And so she was kind of upsetting the apple cart and making it difficult for these other groups. Not deliberately. She wasn't confrontive or anything. But what she wrote certainly made their life more difficult. So, getting back to what I'm trying to describe now, these group rules are really a process of change that accelerates by about one level of initiation the amount of fusing that can take place. So you're starting to really work on an extra body, one whole initiation earlier, and you're doing so because you're relying upon some of the fusing that's taking place in your fellow group members who are at the same time doing the same thing. Wow. And so it's sort of like a true effort, group effort, and you're gaining through that group use. And it's the only way today that you can receive initiation in the physical world. Otherwise, it's all done in the mental world. Now, taking initiation in the physical world means you can still then serve as the next level of initiation while you're in that physical life and not have to wait to come back into the next life. That's a huge and much better level of service in comparison. And also, you're with already a group of people who you're familiar with and who you can, you don't have to meet in the next lifetime and try to form a group about it. Work through all the problems of that entails. So you can see how much more efficient and effective of a process this can be. Wow. But here's the caveat. So far, no group has ever achieved this result. Or are some groups that claim they know what the 14 rules mean and they write about it on the internet or whatever. The point is that nobody's really doing it. In order to do it, you have to have very close contact with the other people. You can't co-serve on the internet or by letters or telephone. You actually have to be together. Now, I know that's going to upset some people who are doing the other thing and thinking they're doing it, but they can't. It's not possible. Why isn't it possible? Because we're talking about sharing bodies. And over the internet, you can't share your physical senses. You can share maybe some etheric parts or electromagnetic parts of them. So you see, it's just you need to be physically around each other. And beyond that, you also have to give everything in the new group rules. All of your abilities has to be given, because in the new group rules, only world service groups will succeed for the first century or two in using the group rules. People who are not into world service and are doing service at less than a world level will find it impossible, even maybe understandable, to ever get near these very difficult to understand group rules, because you have to be committed at such a high level to gain an understanding of what they're about. So if you're not in a world service group at the present time, you won't be able to complete the group rules. Now, after a few world service groups are able to do this, the service groups that surround them will eventually be able to use the group rules by experiencing the model of the world service groups. And so eventually it won't require such a super high level of spiritual service that you're giving everything to serve, because world service literally means that you're going to be using every and all parts of your existence as a soul focused out in service to others. There is no personal life per se. There's only the life of the soul. While World Service is quite difficult. Very few groups are World Service groups, and they are the only groups at the present time that have any crack at using these group rules, or therefore taking initiation physically and having direct contact with a member of the next kingdom. And so far, none have been successful at it. And includes the group I am a member of. Now, our group is attempting to do this. And if we succeed, then that will be a little bit of a different story. But still, the requirements are extremely hard and extremely difficult. And so it is not something to be taken lightly. And you might say, well, then, isn't it true that most World Service groups, since they're the only ones that are going to succeed, if they could, if they're failing, aren't they going to suffer a lot of negative consequences? And there is some truth to that. There's a lot of negative consequences and bad karma that can come out of not succeeding at the present time. A lot of problems that can become present. And remember that illnesses also follow, and other problems follow as a result of our own self-focus. So, got to get over all that stuff if we're going to move ahead with this. The rewards for serving on such an exalted level as in the World Service Group and succeeding in actually completing the group rules for initiation are amazing rewards. It means that each and every member will have contact with a member or more of the next kingdom. That member will co-serve with the teacher of the World Service Group and the leader of that group as well. So it will be in a pretty amazing situation and leave a tremendous amount for the co-creative aspect of becoming part of God, co-creating with God, and experiencing God in a very direct way. Now, World Service groups do this anyway, regardless of how successful they are with the group rules. But the more they are successful with these group rules, and the more that they are successful in the initiatory process, the greater the levels of true service and the greater the levels of a spiritual life and the joy that accompanies such a life. And getting out of all the negative sides of it at the same time. So it's really a beneficial and wonderful process that really anybody could choose to be their life, but the stringent requirements are quite different. I'll quickly go through the differences between the different kinds of groups. World Service groups, as I said, give everything all the time. Their personal interests are put aside, and they live for the service of the group. The service of the group is one of seven specific, both called broad, huge areas of existence. They follow the seven different types of energies that exist in the world, and the seven parts of God that also correspond to seven different dimensions of time and space. These groups stay together for many lifetimes. They serve together for those lifetimes. And they live together past the physical world on into the astral and monastic worlds, continuing to serve at higher and greater levels, usually after physical death. And interestingly, if they don't manage through the group rules in the physical world, they almost always will do so in the monastic world as long as they stay with the group by choice and complete an initiation in the middle world. So that's still a very great thing. And remember, that's done on a group level monastically, so it's still not the way the normal or old-style method is. And there's a lot to be gained from that. Because when you take initiation with others, that means that your body is not only connecting with the other bodies of yourself, but they're connecting with the bodies of all the other members. There's a huge advantage to that in service in the future. says world services, but those are rare and not too common because most people are not going to commit everything that they have, everything that they are, to service. That's a rare event, but when they do, it's a great thing. Some people say, well, I'm willing to commit the next 5 or 10 years of my life, 20 years, and I'll commit maybe a third or a fourth or a half of my abilities in service. Those kinds of people usually become members of what are called national service groups, rather than world service, and they usually apply their efforts to things that are more located within the nation that they live. But it isn't so much that everybody, I know people think that it has to do with the space they live in, like what country you live in or whatever. It really doesn't. It has to do more with the focus of the ray focus of the country you live in, which is different than the country itself. It has to do with the personality and soul nature of the country. And that usually is the focus of the kind of groups that are national service groups in that particular country. Still has a lot to do with the world, but only as the country goes so far in its own development and the people are willing to give within the time that they're willing to put in and the amount of their own energies and their own creative efforts towards becoming and co-creating with God. Generally, it's less than half of their life is spent that way, both on a daily basis and in total time. And it could be significantly less than that. Depends. And then you get into what are known as group service groups. Many, many more of those. Much larger numbers of people can be in group service groups. You have 1 million members of a group service group easily. And sometimes they serve some elements of national service or world service groups. And people are generally in those for like 2 to 5, maybe 7, 8, 10 years max. And sometimes they're in one for 2 years, and then a few years later they might be in one for 5 years, and so 10 years after that they might be in one for 3 years. But they don't stay with it. They only devote a fraction of their life in service. Their life is still mostly personality-driven rather than soul-driven. And they don't usually comprehend what world service is really about. They usually, or for that matter, even national service, they usually think in terms of very specific limited areas of service. Those areas might be extremely important to them. Don't get me wrong. Maybe they're concerned about the environment. Maybe they're concerned about business and the structure of business, or they're concerned about how people are educated and whether or not or the way the government is running. But their processes are limited by how much they're willing to devote their senses completely to the level of service that they're willing to give. And usually that's limited to a small fraction. The majority of people who are in group service groups are first-level initiates. Some are second. Rarely, if ever, are third-level initiates in group service groups, and if they are, only for short periods of time, because they move on. So, generally, it's the lower level of initiate, if they're functioning at all, are in group service groups. Some people go into group service groups more as aspirants, and they never even really get to spiritually disciplining themselves. And then they fall out, come back, fall in, fall out. Some people fail in an initiation and will join for a short period of time a lower group service group, but almost inevitably lose interest in or can't even stay in that group. Usually when you can't function at your level of response, you can't function anywhere below that level. You can only function selfishly. It's so interesting. You either are who you really are meant to be, which is your soul, or you just kind of bomb out eventually, and sometimes quicker than most people might realize. So that's the normal process. Now, there's always exceptions to these rules and general things I'm telling you, but I'm giving you a flavor for what the initiatory process is about, what people are really doing when they are going through it, and how, in some circumstances, they don't make it in other circumstances, they're wildly successful. Success is almost always based upon living at one's a person's level of ability to respond. Then they are truly spiritually responsible, and they can do miraculous things. Now, the ability to respond has nothing to do, like, with your physical abilities or whether you're healthy or well or whatever. It has to do with what's in your heart and how you apply it and how much you are focused out. If you're not focused on yourself and you're focused out, if you do it truly at 100% level, you're living at your level of response. But you have to do it at 100% level. If you do it at a 90% level, then 10% of your responsibilities, spiritual responsibilities, will be lost, and you won't be living at your full level of response, and your capabilities to be your soul are significantly limited then. And each point below that and down the levels becomes more and more of a problem for a person living themselves as a soul at whatever level of response they can. So one person at one level of response may only live 10% of the soul, and another person, which is much higher, maybe a much higher level of initiate too, may be able to live like 75% of the soul. So it's a huge differences that can happen among people. Well, before we run out of time, I thought I'd mention, in case you want to know, on September 20th, if you're in the Phoenix area, around Mesa, if you know where that is, it's the east side of Phoenix, go over to Mesa Fiesta Borders and listen to Mimi talk about the soul and solar angel from 7 p.m. to 8:15 p.m. Borders Books and Music, Alma School in U.S. 60, and there's no charge, and you can go and have an interesting discussion. And anybody in the area or anybody that's visiting us can just go over there and join in. Also, if you have a chance, call Kavita over at Nova Home Loans. She's offering or trying to get people green loans for energy efficiency, especially people who might have their house underwater. Some people will qualify for these green loans, especially if they're in this area. You can reach her at 480-430-6911, Kavita. And finally, I want to mention that if you are interested in any of the products we're offering or going to offer, you can reach us. If you're interested in Soul Balance, you can reach us at there's a couple of different numbers. I just tell you can reach us. You can reach us at 800-777-7850. Try that number, and you can reach us for anything, including ideal cell-sorption resveratrol for yourself or your pets. I'm still using that stuff. It does work, in case you wanted to know about it. I know I haven't had much time to talk about it, but that stuff really does work, and it's pretty much amazing. You want to reach me? thoughts@whylifeis.com. That's right. You can go to our website also if you want to look and see what we're doing these days, agelesswisdom.com. That's another place you can go visit. And let me just sum up today's show by saying that the process of becoming a human initiate and using spiritual discipline to achieve that, and I didn't really go into the definitions of spiritual discipline because I've gone into that many shows, so you should already understand that if you've heard those. If not, you can go to the archives. But the process is an amazing one, difficult, challenging, and at times even painful and suffering, but well worth all of those things, because in the end, you become a liberated soul. Greater than your soul is at the present time in the monastic world. You make yourself into this great being with amazing abilities and amazing ways to become a co-creator with your creator. There's nothing greater. There's nothing better. It's just the most wonderful thing that there possibly can ever have. I hope this has made some sense to you tonight. And for other shows and related subject areas, you can go again to the archives, because there's been a few times when I've gone into this subject in different ways. Okay, until next week, this has been Niles McFlower for Why Life Is.